You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. You're listening to a talk by Noam Chomsky on the Bush administration's Grand Imperial Strategy. We continue.
In 1985, the Nicaragua, which was being subjected to an international terrorist campaign carried out by the current incumbents in Washington, brought a case to the World Court in which they asked the court to order the United States to terminate the terrorism and pay reparations. The United States refused to accept World Court jurisdiction, and that it withdrew its earlier grant of jurisdiction. And it was explained by Judge Abram Sofair, who was the legal advisor of the State Department. He explained it publicly. He said that in the early days of the United Nations, we could count on other countries to go along with what we said, which is true, under, given the conditions of power they had to. And he said, but by now, many other countries in the world just don't agree with us, and therefore we will have to reserve to ourselves the right to determine what falls within the domestic jurisdiction of the United States. In this case, a terrorist war against Nicaragua. Well, that's the other end of the spectrum. Another clear precedent for the national security strategy. However, these, and there are many other cases, but these two examples are different from what happened in September in two crucial respects. Acheson and Sofair were describing policy, and in fact, they were describing it accurately. That's the way it works. But they weren't proclaiming an official policy. That's quite a difference. Furthermore, Acheson and Sofair were talking within the family, so I doubt if many people know about this. You know about it if you're inside a narrow circle of people who pay attention to such things, but the population is not allowed to know that these are the guidelines of policy. We're supposed to believe all sorts of things about benevolence and Wilsonian this and that and so on and so forth. It's only inside closed circles that you're supposed to know about this. On the other hand, the national security strategy of last September was announced loud and clear. They want everybody to know about it. They want everybody to know that we are a revisionist state which uses force to achieve its ends and will do it without limits. That was announced as clearly as possible. The Iraq war made it clear to anybody who didn't believe the words. And that is a very significant difference. There are other precursors, and they're worth looking at too. So take, just to understand ourselves, which is presumably a good thing to do, the National Security Council, which is the top planning body, was established after the Second World War in 1947. Its first memorandum, NSC number one, called for military support for underground operations in Italy, along with national mobilization in the United States. I'm quoting it now, in the event the communists obtain domination of the Italian government by legal means. In other words, there was an election coming up, and it looked as if they'd win. The resistance, anti-fascist resistance, had plenty of prestige, and Italy had a strong labor movement. But if they won the election by legal means, the United States would declare a national mobilization and support paramilitary and other activities inside Italy to overthrow the government. Okay, that's pretty strong state declaration. Fortunately, they were able to win the election by withholding food and reinstating the fascist police and diverting Marshall Plan aid only to the right people and so on. So they didn't win the election by legal means, but if they had, that's what would have happened. We can go back even earlier. So right before the United States got into the Second World War, before Pearl Harbor, there were high-level meetings going on of the State Department and the Council on Foreign Relations planning for the post-war world. I mean, they knew this was a big event, the Second World War. They didn't know if the U.S. would be involved, but plainly it was going to have effects. And they naturally carried out careful planning. And that plans are worth reading. They've been public for 60 years, but they're never read. And they're extremely important, not because, only because they were high-level planning, but because those are the plans that were pretty much implemented after the war. This is the War Peace Studies Group of the State Department and the Council on Foreign Relations. Before the U.S. got into the war in 1940-41, they held that in the post-war world, the United States must hold unquestioned power, and it must act to limit, to ensure limitation of any exercise of sovereignty by states that interfere with U.S. global designs. And they recognized further that the foremost requirement to secure these ends is the rapid fulfillment of a program of complete rearmament, which is a central component of an integrated policy to achieve military and economic supremacy for the United States and to bar any exercise of sovereignty that might threaten it. Well, you'll notice that that's the national security strategy, okay? But again, with the same two reservations. It was plans, but it wasn't an open announcement of an official policy. Plans were indeed implemented. And it's inside. It's for the family, you know, not for the general public to know about, even though it was public. Well, at that time, these ambitions were limited to what they called the non-German world. It was assumed at that time that Germany would end up holding some part of the world. And the non-German world would be organized as what they called a grand area, which would include the Western Hemisphere, the former British Empire, and the Far East. After Russia beat back the Nazi armies at Stalingrad, it was clear that Germany was going to be defeated, and the plans were extended to cover as much of Eurasia as possible. Well, that's earlier precedent. Differing in the important respect that I mentioned. Track of time. Well, let me just make a couple of comments about the implications of all of this. There are some problems in implementing the grand design. Three major problems, one in the oil-producing regions, one in Europe, and one in Asia. They're all kind of the same problem, but different. Now they show up in different ways. So in the Middle East, the primary concern of the United States has been, and for obvious reasons, control of the world's major energy resources. And there's a disruptive factor there, namely the Israel-Palestine conflict. So one problem is to somehow dampen down that problem and regain the support of the oppressive and dictatorial Arab states, which is kind of shaky because of this. And this is understood. So, for example, Michael Ignatieff at Harvard, who's one of the supporters of the Iraq war, had a long article in the New York Times magazine early January supporting the war, in which he pointed out accurately that the chief danger in the Iraq gamble is to enforce a peace Palestinians and Israel. Otherwise, the region will remain in constant ferment. It may blow up, and the U.S. will lose its control of the world's major energy supplies. Well, how do you deal with that? Front pages tell you that there's something called a roadmap, which is a map towards the president's vision of a Palestinian state. I'm sure you've noticed that there's a journalistic convention that when you mention George Bush, you have to mention in the same paragraph his vision or his dream or something like that. And there's usually a picture accompanying it of George Bush staring off into the distance at his vision with his eyes narrowed and so on. One interesting thing about these visions and dreams is that although we're supposed to worship them, no one has a clue what they are. You know, nothing is ever said about what the vision is, and that's important. The public relations people understand that. So if you want to find out something about the vision, you're going to have to look at events. you know, the events of history, documentary record, all forbidden territory that you're not allowed to go into. But that's the only way to find out what the vision is. Well, the fact is that the vision of a Palestinian state is not George Bush's. That was an international consensus back in the mid-70s. There was a very broad international consensus for a two-state settlement on the international borders. And without going into the details, it's been blocked unilaterally from the mid-70s until this minute by the United States. It simply wouldn't allow it. It's vetoed. Security Council resolutions voted alone and with Israel at the General Assembly, and in every possible way has blocked that vision. And nothing's changed in that respect. The same was true right through the Camp David 2000 negotiations. You read about the magnanimous and generous offers that Clinton and Barack were making and how the terrible Palestinians turned them down. But if you look carefully, there's an easy way to test that, very easy way to evaluate how generous and magnanimous the offers were. That's to look at a map. But you can't do that because the media and commentary journals were very careful not to publish a map. So if you search, you won't find a map unless you go out to dissident publications or scholarly sources, or the Israeli press, for example, where they published the maps. And there's a very good reason why the maps weren't published in the United States. As soon as you looked at the maps, you found that the Clinton-Barack proposal sort of made South Africa 40 years ago look pretty good when they were establishing the Bantustans. The Clinton-Barack proposals broke the West Bank into four almost separated cantons, little points of connection between them, one in the north, one in the central region, one in the south, three of them separated from a little area of East Jerusalem, which is the center of Palestinian commercial and cultural life, but is disconnected, and then of course it's all disconnected from Gaza. So kind of a Bantustan proposal. Meanwhile, Clinton and Barack were busily using your dollars, it's paid for by U.S. dollars, of course, to build substantial settlement programs, infrastructure, and so on, to establish the facts of the Bantustan proposal, which was to be implemented at Camp David. Well, what's happened since? Let's take Bush. Bush, there are actions that you can look at, not just visions. So a good place to look is the United Nations, which has meetings at the General Assembly every winter. Bush's first intervention at the United Nations was to veto a Security Council resolution calling for the dispatch of international monitors to reduce the level of violence in the territories. That is the way to do it. But they don't want to do that. They want to allow the violence to continue because they know perfectly well it's overwhelmingly U.S.-backed Israeli violence, and they want that to continue even if it does lead to violence against Israelis. So monitors were blocked. At the same time, this is December 2001, Switzerland, which is the repository of the Geneva Conventions and responsible for them, Switzerland called another meeting, they do it regularly, of the high contracting parties, that's almost every country in the world, to Geneva to deal once again with the applicability of the Geneva Conventions to the occupied territories. Well, in the past, the United States supported that. So for years, the United States voted with the majority, in fact, Security Council, everybody, on the applicability of the Geneva Conventions to the occupied territories. Under Clinton, the United States moved to abstention. Didn't vote against or for, so they continues to be reaffirmed. Bush switched policy and essentially undermined it. He boycotted the meetings in Geneva, and therefore, when the U.S. boycotts something or vetoes it, it's a double veto. For one thing, it's blocked, and for another thing, it doesn't get reported, and it doesn't enter history. So this wasn't reported and didn't enter history, and that's quite important because the Geneva meeting reaffirmed, this is the whole European Union and even England and everybody else, reaffirmed that just about everything that the United States and Israel are doing in the occupied territories is a breach of the Geneva Conventions. And many of them are grave breaches. That means serious war crimes under U.S. law. The Geneva Conventions are not a joke. They were instituted after the Second World War to formally criminalize the crimes of the Nazis, the relevant one, the Fourth Convention, crimes of the Nazis in occupied territories. So the U.S. doesn't want publicly to say they don't apply, but what it's doing is silencing them, and Bush took that a stage forward by undermining the meeting. Well, that's December 2001. December 2002, he went beyond. There's an annual resolution at the General Assembly which reaffirms a Security Council resolution of 1968, passed unanimously, the United States as well, ordering Israel to terminate and withdraw from its actions in occupied East Jerusalem. It's meaningless because the United States never enforces it, but at least it's been voted year after year. This year, for the first time, Bush administration shifted position on that and voted against that resolution. Well, if that's meant seriously, that ends any possibility of a political settlement. It means it's authorizing Israel's occupation of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem by now is a huge area, cutting out a big piece of the West Bank. It's nothing like Jerusalem used to be. So that virtually cuts the West Bank in two, if the U.S. meant it. And there's every reason to think that they do. Bush's next statement about the Middle East was in February of this year. It was called, highly touted in the press as his most significant comment on the Middle East, repeated right away by Powell. Most of it was just the usual boilerplate, wouldn't be nice to have peace, and so on and so forth. But there was one significant statement in it. Namely, he said that U.S.-backed Israeli settlements could continue without limit until progress is made in the peace process, and he'll decide when progress is being made. That's, again, a significant shift in policy. Up until now, there have at least been gestures to say that the settlements are illegal or maybe unhelpful or something, but this was a straight authorization of them. If you look at the roadmap, I won't go through the details, but it essentially repeats that. It says nothing about borders. It says nothing. In fact, it says something vague about terminating what's called natural growth in the settlements, but Ariel Sharon, the official man of peace, as he was called by Bush, immediately told the Israeli Knesset that don't worry about it, you can build there for your children and your grandchildren. So my soulful relation with President Bush guarantees that. And that's correct. So what's happening is just a continuation and extension of the policies of undermining any hope for a peaceful political settlement there. That's if you look at the facts. Of course, if you keep to the vision, well, then you can believe what you like. One final comment, because it's getting too late, but this is a really important topic, so it should be mentioned. Another comment has to do with Europe and Asia, especially Northeast Asia. There's a long-standing problem in post-war international affairs, and that is whether Europe will be subordinated to the United States or will pursue its own path. Okay, Europe's rich place, big place, on the scale of the United States, economies on a scale of the United States, educated and so on, it's conceivable that it might go off on its own path. And that's always been a problem. The United States was in favor of the integration of Europe for all kind of reasons, but it was wary that it might take off on its own. This was described very lucidly by Henry Kissinger when he was National Security Advisor and Secretary of State back in 1973. 1973 was called the Year of Europe, to celebrate the unification of Europe. And Kissinger gave what's called the Year of Europe address, in which he informed the Europeans that they have to understand that Europe has what he called regional responsibilities within the overall framework of order maintained by the United States. In other words, don't think about posing a challenge. You can carry out your, you can take care of, you know, immigration in the Mediterranean or whatever your regional responsibilities are, but it's within the framework of order maintained by the United States. That continues. Europe means primarily France and Germany. That's the industrial, financial heartland of Europe. And a large part of the hysteria about France and Germany in the last couple of months, which is kind of interesting in itself, but a large part of the hysteria has to do with concern that Europe might strike out on an independent course, as it could. Okay, the same problems are arising in Asia. Northeast Asia, which includes Japan, South Korea, China, Eastern Siberia, is by now, and has been for some years, the most dynamic economic region in the world. Its gross domestic product is considerably larger than the United States. It's growing fast. It has about half the financial reserves of the world. It's a major source of foreign direct investment in and by now out. It's an integrated region, has plenty of resources. Eastern Siberia and China have resources. The industrial countries of the region need the resources. It's a very natural unit, and it's significant, except in military force. It's on a par with the United States and Europe. Well, that's a concern, because Northeast Asia also could move on its own towards independence. You know, there's a lot of fuss now about North Korea, and this is part of what's behind it. I mean, the regional countries, all of them, want to pursue some kind of negotiated diplomatic settlement with North Korea, somehow integrate it, a horrible place, but they don't want a war, that would be too awful. They want to move to integrating it into the region somehow. And that makes a lot of sense from every point of view. Pipelines from Siberia through into South Korea through North Korea, or expansion of the Trans-Siberian Railroad into South Korea, would be important moves towards integrating the region. And as one high-level U.S. planning document, really recent analysis really put it, pipelines through North Korea could enhance regional stability and provide cheap alternatives to oil imported from the Middle East. Well, one of the ways the U.S. controls Northeast Asia and Europe is by controlling its energy resources. If they move towards independent energy resources and other resources, that would be a spur towards separating into an independent area. And with the resistance to the national security strategy that Eikenberry quoted, this is exactly what's feared, that other parts of the world are going to break out of this system, create their own areas, which could lead to unpleasant conditions if the U.S. really does insist on barring any challenge by violence, as it has stated that it will. These are the things that I think are right in the offing.
You've been listening to a talk by Noam Chomsky on the Bush administration's Grand Imperial Strategy, recorded on May 29th in Arlington, Massachusetts. A question period followed the talk, and we're about to play that for you. The questions were off mic and thus hard to hear, so I've paraphrased them. The first questioner said she was a political activist and was feeling frustrated because activism didn't seem to be having any impact on government officials. She asked how to talk to members of Congress to get them to stand up to the administration.
Well, first of all, I don't agree that it doesn't make any difference. I think it makes a huge difference. So, for example, if you just look over the history of recent years, you can see the difference. The first time I lobbied Congress, actually first and last time, was with Howard Zinn. We went down in April 1965 to talk to our congressional representatives and senators. This was right after Lyndon Johnson had expanded the war in South Vietnam to the bombing of the North. I won't run through the details, but we couldn't even talk to them. Tip O'Neill wouldn't let us into his office. Saltonstall, who was the senior senator, said, well, you know, kind of let us give him our rap and said, interesting, but the president has spoken. What are you talking about? Kennedy, who was then a junior senator, said, you know, it sounds kind of interesting, but I'm not much my brother's. My brother takes care of foreign policy issues. Of the people in Congress, so the only ones we could even talk to were a couple of Republican representatives, or at least who were in fact kind of helpful. But that's just changed over the years. And by now, there's much more access and much more pressure because the population's changed. They are under popular pressure. And to the extent that they're under popular pressure, they will do things. They're not going to stand up alone. Very few do. I mean, you can count them on the fingers of one hand. There's an Ernst Gruning, and you know, occasionally you'll find someone else. But these are people who are happy to say, I'm your leader, when there's enough people around for them to be the leader of. And it has to be not just large in numbers, but active and committed. These things aren't achieved in a minute, you know. The anti-war movement in Vietnam took years before it got off the ground. The situation today is far more advanced than it was then. You didn't have hundreds of thousands of people on the street before Kennedy started bombing South Vietnam in 1962. It's different. And it's not just that, it's everything else too. You know, civil rights, women's rights, environmental issues, all sorts of things that countries just changed. And it's changed because, we all have to understand these things don't happen fast. These are long struggles. I mean, abolitionism took forever, you know. It didn't happen by one demonstration. So, yeah, you have to create the groundwork for it. And in fact, in the United States, it's... My feeling is it's an easy, terrific situation for organizing people. The only way people are kept in line by now is by terrifying them with phantoms. And they are phantoms, you know, and it's not hard for people to get to understand that. But it's not going to happen easily. You know, it's going to take work because people really are afraid. And you can overcome that fear, but only by hard work. Pardon?
How can you make the media quit lying to us?
The media have their own agenda, which is to support power. If the general population changes and the culture changes and people's commitments and beliefs change, the media will partially reflect it. Otherwise not. In the same way that, I mean, for example, when the first, go back to 1965 again. 1965 happened to be the first public demonstration against the international demonstrations against the Vietnam War. And there was a big demonstration here on the Boston Common. It didn't take place. It was broken up by counter-demonstrators violently. I was supposed to be one of the speakers, and the only way I got out alive was because there were a couple hundred state troopers around. The Boston Globe covered it, supporting the counter-demonstrators and denouncing the people who were daring to stand up and say, maybe we shouldn't bomb North Vietnam. Well, that changed over a couple of years, and it didn't change because their genes changed. It changed because the country changed, and that's where you have to work.
The second questioner asked how to overcome the fear that pervades the body politic that Chomsky discussed, and how to move the political debate away from the national security agenda that plays upon those fears.
Well, you know, if there were a magic key to open these doors, somebody would have told us about it a long time ago. And there isn't. The only way to deal with it is by patient, constant educational and organizing activities. And we have to face reality. It is a very frightened country. It's not new, and it's not just Saddam Hussein. Take, say, crime. Crime in the United States is approximately like other industrial countries. Fear of crime, on the other hand, is way beyond other industrial countries. Same true of drugs. In other countries like ours, industrial countries, drugs are considered sort of a problem. You know, you deal with them. Here, it's turned into a threat to our survival. You know, if Canada is going to make the perfectly rational move of not arresting people for and throwing them in jail forever for having a small amount of pot, people here will go crazy. You know, if they may cut off relations with Canada. Okay, those are things that. Those are the results of long and effective propaganda programs. They go way back. And it does go way back. I mean, some of you will be old enough to remember, I'm sure, that back in the early 60s, well, my own, in Lexington, where I live, back in the early 60s when my kids were in school, they were literally being taught to hide under desks in the Lexington schools to protect them from atom bombs. Well, you know, we can laugh, but they didn't laugh, you know. And there's no place in the world where anybody was, where there was anything like this. I mean, for a long time, it's been an extremely frightened country. And that is exploited by unscrupulous leaders. And they're going to try to exploit it for the next election, just as Rovitz said. And the only way to deal with this is to get to people and, you know, help them, participate with them so that they can get us a sane grasp of reality. And that can certainly be done. I mean, it's been done on all sorts of issues. We don't have to go back very far to see how it's done. I mean, I mentioned a couple of cases. Let me take another one. I mean, there is an original sin in this country, very straightforward original sin, namely, why are we here? You know, what happened to the people who were living here? Well, you know, what happened, you know, is that they were exterminated. Millions of them, like it wasn't small. Well, until the 1960s, that was simply not an issue. It wasn't an issue in scholarship. It wasn't an issue in consciousness. When I was a kid, we played cowboys and Indians, and we were the cowboys, and we were killing the Indians. I can't say it's there's been a that it's so marvelous today. It isn't, but there's an enormous change in that respect, because people's awareness and consciousness has changed on issue after issue. And it doesn't happen by a gift. It happens by hard, dedicated, constant work. And it takes time. I mean, take something like women's rights. You know, it took centuries before it became right on the agenda.
The third questioner asked why the Palestinians accepted the Bush so-called roadmap. And he also asked Chomsky to comment on the USA Patriot Act and the abridgment of the Freedom of Information Act.
Patriot Act is a pretty rotten act. It has a lot of horrible things in it. But so far, it has been used mostly against very vulnerable people, where they're pretty sure they can get away with it, you know, like illegal immigrants and so on. They certainly want to use it against everybody. I mean, there's a real fascist streak in the administration. There's no doubt about it. And they would like to be able to really undo the whole civil libertarian tradition. But it's not so simple, because people are not going to accept it easily. With regard to the Freedom of Information Act, there haven't been many changes. I mean, the Bush administration, like the Reagan administration, wants the government to be free from scrutiny by citizens. They are not conservatives. They're reactionary statists. They don't think that the population has any right to know what the government's doing. So the Reagan administration very radically undermined efforts to get declassified documents from 30 years earlier. And the Bush administration is trying to do the same thing. But so far they haven't succeeded very much. And whether they succeed or not is up to us. You know, I mean, they can't really do these things if the citizens won't allow it. They're pushing it as hard as they can go, and they're pushing very hard. So just a couple of days ago, I don't know if this even made the papers, but there is a legislation which has been upheld by the courts for the last 20 years, the Alien Torts Claims Act, which actually goes back to the 18th century, which allows people to bring suits against foreign foreigners or their local affiliates for acts like torture and so on and so forth. So you can bring a suit in an American court against a Indonesian torture and so on, and against corporations. Well, one of the suits that's going on is an important one. It's worked up through the courts in California, is a suit against Unocal, big oil company, for using what amount to slave laborers in Burma. And it's being filed under this act, and it's moving along. The Ashcroft Justice Department just intervened with a first time to with a amicus brief to support Unocal and to call for termination of any use of this act against for torture victims and slave labor victims and so on. I mean, they really want to cut out civil liberties at every point you can look at. The new Patriot 2 Act, which they're thinking of, they're trying to sneak it through. It's leaked. You know, it hasn't been made public. It's leaked on the internet. And law professors have written about it. So, I mean, they are actually intending to claiming the right to take away citizenship on simply on what they call inference. So if the Attorney General infers, you know, from some pattern of action of yours that you're a terrorist supporter, or whatever that means, they want to be able to take away your citizenship. I mean, that's unheard of in any Western society. But they will go as far as they can, and they have to be stopped, or else it'll be in bad trouble. As for why the Palestinians accepted the roadmap, it's first of all, it's the Palestinian Authority that accepted the roadmap. What the Palestinians may have in mind is another matter. But I can understand why they would have done it. I mean, they don't have a lot of alternatives. They are hoping they're under an illusion, I think, but they're hoping that somehow the U.S. is going to change its traditional position on this. There's no evidence for it, but they're hoping for it. And there's only one way to realize that hope, and that is for us here to force that change to take place. They can't do anything about it.
The next questioner mentioned recent news reports that the invasion of Iraq had been planned long ago and asked how the administration's increasingly belligerent rhetoric towards Iran factors into the grand strategy.
Yeah, well, there has been some interesting stuff coming out about the actual planning for the war. I mean, it's been pretty obvious that they had made their minds up quite early, and most of everything was going on was for show. But for those of you who want to look at it a little more closely, there's quite a good series that came out in the what I think is the best newspaper in the world, the London Financial Times business newspaper, best international business newspaper, had a detailed investigation of the planning, you know, as far as they could unearth from talking to people on the National Security Council and so on. And what they ended up with, and it's plausible, is that by mid-December, the Bush administration had decided there was definitely going to be a war. And their reasoning is interesting. It tells you a lot. The reasoning is and it's plausible. The reasoning was described by a high official who was involved in the National Security Council planning. He said by early December, the administration had the feeling that, I'm virtually quoting it, that a tin pot dictator is mocking us. And we don't let tin pot dictators mock us. That's called establishing credibility in international affairs or in the mafia, which are very similar. A mafia don does not allow some local tin pot to mock him. And if you have the biggest military force in the world and you know you're immune from retaliation, you don't let them mock you either. So we'll go destroy the country or whatever we feel like doing. It fits very well with mentality, and it bears on Iran. I mean, the problem with Iran is it fails the first condition of those three conditions. Actually, it fails two of the conditions. It's an ugly place in many ways, but you can't claim that it has a horrendous record like, say, plenty of other states in the world. But the worst thing is it's not defenseless. And since it's not defenseless, it can't be attacked. So what the U.S. has been trying to do for some time, it's not just starting now, is to try to carry out subversive activities internal to Iran, which will fragment it or maybe cause uprisings or something. So there's pretty good reason to believe that for the last, at least for the last year and maybe farther back, the U.S. has been trying to stir up Azeri nationalist movements in the north, which do want independence and have some justification. In fact, the U.S. is now trying to do what appears what the Russians did in 1946, which is one of the early Cold War confrontations, where they tried to support Azerbaijani independence within Iran, which would have split up Iran. And the U.S. practically went to war over that at the time. But now it looks as though the U.S. is trying to do the same thing. And there are very complicated dealings going on in that region with the, you know, Azeri, Turkish, Israeli alliance, you know, trying to take power and control. There's pretty good evidence that a good part of the Israeli Air Force, which is not a small air force, it's bigger than and more technologically advanced than any NATO air force, except the U.S., a lot of it's stationed in eastern Turkey, and they're apparently flying reconnaissance over Iran as part of a preparation for some kind of action. It's probably not a direct attack, because Iran can fight back. In fact, the U.S. is now driving Iran towards developing weapons of mass destruction, almost transparently. And, you know, intelligence agencies have pointed this out, strategic analysts have pointed it out. I mean, the U.S. is making it clear to the world, and has been for some time, that if you're defenseless, we're going to attack you. So you better have a deterrent. And there's only two kinds of deterrent. One is terror, and the other is weapons of mass destruction. So the Bush administration is quite openly causing proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and increasing terror. I mean, you know, every intelligence agency and their own analysts pointed out to them that the invasion of Iraq, that Iraq had, whatever you think about Saddam Hussein, he had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda and those guys, they're his worst enemies. But attacking Iraq would increase the threat of terror. And apparently that's what's happening. Reports from around the world are that with the buildup of the invasion and then the invasion itself, recruiting for Al-Qaeda-style organizations is going up fast. And we just saw two major terrorist attacks, which may well be the effect of it. But they're perfectly willing to face that. I mean, they don't want terror, but they don't really mind that much. You know, if there are terrorist attacks or weapons of mass destruction, you know, not nice, but it's of low priority as compared with higher ones, like ramming through the domestic agenda and controlling the world. And furthermore, they know perfectly well that they can exploit terrorist attacks. I mean, there could be a serious terrorist attack in the United States. If you really want to be frightened correctly, take a look at the Hart-Rudman report on terrorist threats in the United States, high-level planning analysis that just came out. Good people. I mean, what they say makes sense. I mean, there's horrendous possibilities. I mean, it's like a cookbook. You know, we can do many of those things without very much talent, you know. And it's going to happen, and it will. You can increase the likelihood of it by refusing to ask where it's coming from. You know? If you react to it by violence, you increase it. I mean, every terrorist specialist knows this. If you look at the grievances and you try to deal with them and so on, well, you can reduce the threat. They're doing the opposite. And the same is true with Iran. I mean, they probably are forcing Iran to accelerate efforts, if they have them, to develop weapons of mass destruction for perfectly sensible reasons. How are they going to defend themselves from a U.S. attack? And maybe to get involved with terrorist organizations, though there's no evidence that they are. The U.S. claims that they're involved with terrorist organizations, but you have to look at the definition of terrorist. So high on the U.S. list of terrorist organizations, very high, is Hezbollah. Okay, why is that a terrorist organization? Well, because it drove a U.S. client out of Lebanon. I mean, Israel invaded Lebanon 20 years ago, killed around 20,000 people, stayed on, ran a brutal military occupation in the south, and they were driven out by Hezbollah. Okay, that makes Hezbollah terrorists. Just like the current administration, the guy, you know, Powell, Rumsfeld, the rest, regarded the Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress as, in their words, one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. because they were resisting our ally, South Africa. So you've got to be really cautious about what's called terrorism. I'm not saying the Hezbollah are nice people, probably, you know, probably not. But their main, the main charge against them is that they drove a U.S. client out of an illegal military occupation. And it's undoubtedly true that Iran is supporting them.
The last questioner returned to the topic of fear and how it has affected the anti-war movement specifically. Some people, the questioner said, felt that the primary focus of the movement should be to beat Bush, and thus any Democrat would do, while others wanted to address the larger systemic issues. She asked for Chomsky's opinion on what strategy should be followed.
Well, I mean, right, son. I mean, and look, the people running Washington now happen to be an unusually dangerous crowd within a spectrum that isn't that broad. That's what I was trying to suggest by quoting Dean Acheson and the planners of the Franklin Roosevelt period and others. I mean, it's a narrow spectrum. And nevertheless, within that spectrum, there can be differences, and those differences can... These guys have so much power in their hands that small differences can translate into huge outcomes. So I think it makes good sense to prevent, I don't care about Bush, but the crowd around him from wielding power. On the other hand, any Democrat, I mean, Democrats have done the same things, you know. What has to be done is change the environment in which any of these guys are going to do something. And yeah, it's the just what you said is exactly correct. It's this 40 years of work have made a huge difference, not just in this area, in every area. I mean, anybody our age knows it. You know? So take my own university, MIT. I've been there for about 50 years. If you walk through the halls of MIT today, it's half women, about a third minorities, people casually dressed, which reflects personal relationships, means not much authority and subordination. If you walk through the same halls 40 years ago, it would have been white males, well-dressed, ties and jackets, obedient, you know. I mean, those are just changes that have taken place everywhere, and they're not insignificant. They've changed the country, and they change politics, and they change the media and everything else. It doesn't come easily. The fear is very real. But, you know, that's the kind of element that, in a way, it's easy to combat. It's hard to combat security forces who are going to take you away and blow your brains out and throw you in jail and torture you. Okay, we're lucky. We don't combat that. What we combat is a culture of fear and subordination. Now, that's a lot easier to deal with. So, but it takes hard work.
Noam Chomsky on the Bush administration's grand imperial strategy, recorded May 29th in Arlington, Massachusetts. Thanks to Martin Volker of No U-Turn Radio for that tape. The corporate media is now reporting what we community broadcasters reported more than 6 months ago, that all the reasons given by the administration to the people for the invasion of Iraq were lies, and that the real purpose was to control Iraq's oil. It's not that we have better information than well-funded media giants. They knew this too, but their bosses didn't want you to know this. So they told the story they were paid to tell, so they could keep their big salaries and prestigious careers. They lied to you, and they knew they were lying to you, because they're not stupid people either. Why? So that you would fund and fight their war to steal oil, so that you wouldn't use your collective might to rise up and stop them. You were to know only what the administration and their cronies all cut in on a piece of the action in various ways wanted you to know. You were to wrap a yellow ribbon around your brain and wave your flag as your friends, relatives, and neighbors were sent off to murder and maim tens of thousands of people in another country, maybe die or be maimed themselves, so that Bush's pals could steal oil. If you are one of those law and order people that love putting criminals in jail, I would appreciate if you could explain to me what is the difference between a guy who pulls you over and kills you so he can steal your car and the Bush administration and their collaborators of whatever political party who invade a country and kill thousands of people to steal their natural resources. You can write to me via our website at www.unwelcomeguests.org. Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz may be a rotten man, but he's not a stupid man. Why does he now feel able to tell the truth? Because it's too late. The corpses litter Iraq and his pals have the oil, and clearly nobody anywhere has the gonads to stop them. And also, the New York Times can now report the truth to you, because Wolfowitz made the statement, and faithfully, objectively repeating the utterances of government officials is now the main duty of the press, don't you know? I'd like to address the next part especially to listeners to 88.1, which is heard throughout most of Tompkins County. The reason you're hearing this is because a few members of the community went out of pocket to the tune of $10,000 to put this station on the air. And this is only the beginning. We have formed Ithaca Community Radio, and I say we because I am one of the founding trustees, along with two of the producers of the Ithaca Radio Hour, Jesse Lind and Jeff Kirby, as well as Kenny Ritter, host of the cable TV program The Luminary News, and Renee Borghella, a conservation biologist and teacher at Tompkins Cortland Community College. Other members of the community, forgive me if I don't acknowledge each of you by name just right now, are working with us to realize the ultimate goal of this project. A community radio station beholden to no corporate or government funders, that exists to report honestly, to challenge power and corruption, to encourage and support the values and creative efforts of our community, and to give other members of the community, like ourselves, the ability to use the airwaves to communicate on the things we care about, things which are only rarely reflected in other media, and which are, more often than not, derided or distorted. Values like peace, cooperation, internationalism, ecology, creativity, originality, and community over greed, competition, militarism, nationalism, conformity, obedience, and punishment. If you support the goal of having such a media outlet for ourselves, please contribute what you can. You can get more information through our website, www.ithacaradio.org, or just send us anything to Post Office Box 6782, Ithaca 14851. That's Post Office Box 6782, Ithaca 14851. Thank you. The theme music for this program, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. But tonight, we'll go out with another song by Ethan Miller, called Everything's Fine. We'll dedicate this to Michael Powell, chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, for his recent contribution to making sure that Americans get all lies, all the time, from the media.
Turn on the television. Open up a magazine. Hear the broadcast of the massacre. Read about some tragedy. See the man with the pretty face. Summarize the daily news. Turn the pages, hear the whispering. Follow the voices. Telling you everything's fine, everything is okay. Don't you worry about a thing. town. And all our problems go away. Everybody close your eyes. Everyone look the other way. Everything is just dandy. There's no trouble. Just the other day, another black man was shot dead. 20 bullets from the barrels of a police gun shot him in the back while he fled. The people rose up, they took to the streets to defy these racist pigs. They met him with batons and their tear gas guns. The next day the police chief said, everything's fine, everything is okay. Don't you worry about it. Don't you worry.